Welcome back to another episode of Awareness to Action Enneagram Podcast. My name is Creek, and I'm with my intrepid co-host today, Mario Sikora. And wait a second, is that Lee Fields?
Lee Fields is back with us.
Where'd you come from? What?
From this tiny rectangle on the computer screen.
Yes, which most of our interactions have resided in. All yes, right. Mm-hmm. Yes. Maria Jose is where today?
Well, look, you know, the real story is, you know, while I was gone, she was getting a little too big for her britches, you know? And so, I had to put her in the pimp now. She's working. She's at an offsite workshop with a client and was unable to be with us today. So Lee graciously stepped in.
Yes.
Glad to be here.
Lee and I constantly feel like the kids caught between the fighting parents.
I was thinking about that today, and I was wondering if brother sister is more of a love fair. Each other and would defend each other to death, but bicker all the time, you know?
So, that's
so. That's all right, fair. We can be caught between the bickering aunt and uncle.
Anyways, today I was surprised about this. We're going to be talking about the vices, the virtues, and the fixations.
Why were you surprised?
It's part of the older Enneagram. It's part of the normal Enneagram. And it has some, like, it has ties to the centers. It has ties to metaphysics. All those sort of things. I know you reference them sometimes, but I don't ever remember talking about them explicitly. So, Lister, I'm going in blind. Other than the equivalent of the Library of Alexandria Mario sent us last night at 8 p.m.
Eastern.
Eastern, yes.
I think that we're having a... classical underpinnings of the Enneagram start at the very beginning. It's a very fine place to start kind of conversation.
Yeah, there it is. Very nice. Very nice.
Yeah, well, I think the idea of this came out of a conversation that Lee and I had a while back where I forget exactly, you know, what brought it about, but talking about things that we don't teach and the reasons that we don't really teach the vices, virtues, and fixations is because I always just assumed, well, you know, other people do that and do it better. And, Lee said, well, maybe they don't do it better, so maybe we should, you know, take a whack at it, right? And so,
Lee? Lee said that?
Well, I'm assuming that because this is not something we really focus on, that there are people who teach it better and who teach it, you know, in a more robust way. But I've yet to find it, quite frankly, and, you know, the things that I've seen. You know, I did a little research afterwards, and I said, yeah. Now, look, you know, Sandra Maitrey's book is great on this, you know, and there are some good things. But again, it takes a specific metaphysical position, right? Mm-hmm. Again, it's wrapped up in the Neoplatonic perspective. And one of the things that you realize when you start digging into this a little bit, and thus my Library of Alexandria document to you guys last night was this is the, you know, there's not just one approach to this, right? I mean, this is something that people have been talking about for thousands of years, and everybody talks about it differently, right? Everybody's got their own list of vices and virtues. And, you know, again, which brings us back to this idea, you know, it's, you know, and this is a pet peeve of mine these days, that there are people who are saying, oh, the Enneagram is ancient and, you know, it's part of this, you know, this intact stream of wisdom. And that's just nonsense, right? And, you know, this gives us a good opportunity to show one more way in which mm-hmm. that's nonsense.
Great.
Shall I say more? I
mean, is there any more to say about the vices and the virtues? Really? Well,
yeah. Yeah, let's get into the origin and how they kind of came to be, and kind of the evolution of the terms. And we'll get into the specifics of the terms next, but just do history.
Okay, so... And before we get into the history, I think there's value in this, right? I think it's useful to understand these things, right? Mm-hmm. And so I encourage people to understand these because for a couple of reasons. Number one, it's good stuff, right? Mm-hmm. Number two, it is part of the traditional Enneagram, and one of the better parts of the traditional Enneagram. In fact, it is the traditional Enneagram when it comes right down to it. Now, Chazo taught a couple of other things like the holy ideas and the I forget what else, but there were a number of other Enneagrams that he talked about. But these are the core. Okay, right. So I think anybody who studies the Enneagram really should understand these things.
Okay. And that, just one more caveat, yeah. That is, I think, important for our listeners to know, is when you say the things I don't teach, it's holding a large category of things, things that are just dumb, mm-hmm. and things that are just, categories. Yeah, I'm trying to bring this back.
So there are things that are objectively wrong. Right, that mm-hmm. are taught in the Enneagram world that, you know, I wouldn't teach because they're just
factually. Not even wrong.
I think that's a second category, right? Yeah. I mean, there are things there are things that are factually wrong. You know, you point to them and say, yeah, that's just not how it works, right? And, you know, the idea that there are three instincts, for example, okay? Well, no, they're not. And then there are the things that are not even wrong. And by that, they're either, mm-hmm. you know, incoherent or completely non-falsifiable. So therefore, they're just opinions or beliefs or metaphysical statements that one can just dismiss, right? But even some of those, you know, again, with this whole Neoplatonic essentialism thing, it's just nobody does that anymore. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, it's like it's not something that's taken seriously in serious circles. So, mm-hmm. And there'll be one or two people who disagree with me on that, but you know, oh well.
I was just going to offer the observation that some of the things that have been taught in classical Enneagram sort of beliefs have been falsified by science. Like some neuroscience things have been conflated with the Enneagram or to your point, the instincts. And so there's a natural updating that seems commonsensical, but more invited into those spaces. Whereas you and your approach in the ATA model is sort of updating a lot of the concepts to like a more rigorous approach to those dynamics.
Yeah. Yes. The Enneagram's an explanation. Okay. And all theories, all models are explanations, and explanations should be continually updated as we learn new things. Right. So, there's a saying that, you know, today's great explanation is tomorrow's terrible explanation. Okay. Because it just sounds dumb in the future, but it's the best explanation we have at this point. So, so the Enneagram, I think, just like everything else, should be looked at that same way. Okay, well, this was a good explanation for, you know, 100 years ago or whatever. Mm-hmm. But now it's not such a good explanation. So let's update it a little bit. Okay. Yeah. And so the third category, Creek, is the things that, you know, might have some validity to them, but they raise either a level of complexity, a level of confusion, or a level of kind of taking the person out of the game mentally that's beyond the value of it. And this is where, for me, the vices and virtues, you know, fit in, because they require a lot of explanation to really understand them. I mean, the superficial applications of these that I see all over the place are really problematic and, you know, make it not really worth much. But also, you know, you're talking about some sensitive things, you know, lust and gluttony and anger and envy and greed that, you know, don't always, are not suitable for a lot of environments, particularly the business environment where I often work.
And can be just confusing.
Yes.
How do you find this lofty sort of concept in your practical experience of yourself?
Right. Right. And, you know, and they bring value if you really understand them, right? So take sloth and point nine. So people say, oh, the nine's the sloth type. That means they're lazy. So Lee, your husband's an attorney and he's a nine. You don't become an attorney and make your living doing something like that by being a lazy person, right? So that's not the kind of sloth that people are talking about. I can't tell you how many very senior executives I've worked with over the years who are very hardworking people who are nines. But the sloth that they're talking about is very different from what people tend to think of as sloth. So this is where they become a challenge. They just require too much explanation in most environments.
All right, let's put on our Indiana Jones hat and let's go discover the origins of this concept.
Okay. So first of all, it's important to understand that the Enneagram of vices, virtues, fixations that we have today starts with a Chazo. Okay. There, again, there's this idea that it existed before him and he just, adopted it from, that's just not the case. And in fact, this has been settled in court, right? There was a famous intellectual property case where Ichazo was suing early Enneagram teachers and while it was determined that you can't copyright the Enneagram, it was into the record that the Enneagram started with Ichazo, right? It was his unique, original, intellectual contribution. And, I found a copy of a book that interviews with Oscar Ichazo. I not found it. I knew I had it. But I found it years and years and years ago. It was written. I found a train ticket from 1988. In the pages, which is weird because I didn't really know about the Enneagram until 94. So I've been trying to figure out if that's my train ticket or somebody else's. But anyway,
tickets used to be paper.
Yes, kids. Right?
Strange.
So imagine those things your parents have called books, right? And if you were to tear out part of one of those pages, yeah, that's what a ticket was. Yeah. Anyway, there's a chapter in here, one of the interviews, titled, "I am the root of a new tradition." Okay, so Ichazo is just coming right out and saying, "Oh yeah, I'll tell you, if you can get your hands on this, interviews with Oscar Ichazo, man, it's going into a rabbit hole." Really fascinating, and
it's a character study.
It's certainly a character study. I mean, he was a character, and he was trying to change society, right? I mean, he had this vision that he and his followers were going to save society, which was on the fast track to dissolution, and he was going to basically create some sort of socialist utopia, right? And it was very 70s, very idealistic and all that stuff. And, stick it to the man and down with capitalism and all these things. And some of his ideas were really, really interesting. And some of them were really, really crazy, quite frankly. And but there's a whole lot of metaphysics in there. Anyway, what we know as the vices, virtues, and fixations begins with Ichazo, but the concept goes way, way back in multiple forms, and that we can discuss. And look, I don't want to disparage Ichazo too much because his contribution was huge, right? I think he was wrong about a lot of things. I think a lot of his stuff was irrelevant and doesn't hold up that well. But man, mapping the Enneagram that he did, that was brilliant. It was huge. So I don't want to tear them down.
Well, that's part of why we're here, right? We're standing on some of that material.
Yes.
Now.
Yes. And again, this is the way it should be, right? I mean, every explanation, we should look at it and say, yeah, okay, well, this part's really, really good, but this part needs work or needs to be, taken out or whatever. So, it's just the way it is, as you say. I must call you Maria Jose.
I'm in Maria Jose's seat.
Hi.
Hi.
do you have sangria with you, Lee?
I do not. But okay. I'll try to razz you a little bit if it would make you feel more comfortable. That's right. Yeah.
So,
you want to do the acorn and the oak tree example?
No. We'll hold on to that one.
All right.
Okay. So let's get back to this idea, right? So. Now, vices and passions are kind of interchangeable, right, as terminology, okay? They sort of mean the same thing. And this idea that, of the vices or passions usually are associated with being the opposite of a virtue, Okay, so you start with the virtue, and then you say, okay, well, what's the opposite of that? And that's the vice. And again, depending on who you're reading, because this idea appears in many forms and, you know, in many different places, it's the vice or the fixation could develop because of a loss of contact with the passion. I'm sorry, with the virtue, or it can be from a loss of contact with God, or it can be a loss of contact with the healthy ego. So, whenever we feel the loss of something, we need to fill it in with something else. And so, you know, that's one way of thinking about these things. But the idea of virtues, I mean, you can trace back, you know, to, as Wikipedia does, and so it must be right, to the Egyptians, you know, there was the Egyptian goddess Maat, you know, that was there to put order on the chaos of the universe. And there's a list of virtues associated with that. But again, it's not the same list that we have today. And then you go on to, you know, Plato, and he had a list of virtues and passions. And again, for him, it was when we lose contact with our essence or with the essence of the universe, we fill it in with these other things. And then Aristotle has a different approach to it, right? Aristotle was not so much about the essence. It was more of a logical and I wouldn't quite call it secular, but much more secular approach to this, right? So, you know, for him, you know, the virtue is a thing done in the right proportion, okay? You can kind of go overboard with too much of something. You can go, you know, with too little of something. Virtue is that thing in the middle. He called it the golden mean. Okay, the integration of, you know, something overdone and something underdone. Now, the early Christians were big on Aristotle, and so they brought a lot of Aristotelian thinking into this. Okay, and again, for the early Christians, it was, how do we lose separation with God? Okay, and so this is, you know, it's through these passions. So again, they've evolved, and the most famous, I guess, iteration of the list of vices or passions are the seven deadly sins, okay, which, you know, kind of developed in the medieval period. I was just in Spain, as we mentioned last time. for just the so manyth time, I can't even remember. But no, and one of the things I try to do when I go to Madrid is go to the Prado Museum. And there are a number of paintings by, they call him Bosco there, but in the West, he's Dutch, so it would have been Hieronymus Bosch. And one of his most famous paintings is the seven deadly sins and the four final things. Okay, so you've got, you know, in the corners, you've got death, judgment, heaven, and hell. And in the middle, you've got this wheel of the seven deadly sins. Although, interestingly, in the 1500s, it wasn't lust, but it was, I wrote it down here so I didn't forget, extravagance, okay, which is different from what we think of as lust. So even then, the idea was different, you know, and this is, you know, 500 years ago, okay? So again, these things have evolved over time, and eventually it migrated to the idea of lust. And, but we get to Achazo, and Achazo says, okay, here are the nine. Here are the official nine, because in Achazo's mind, everything was nine, right? Nine was the magic number, so it had to be nine of something. There are people who say that Ramon Llull, you know, was the first person to do this, or the earliest iteration of the Enneagram, but he wasn't. If you do 2 minutes of research, you realize that he had a quote-unquote Enneagram-like diagram, but he had 16 points on it, and he had 16 with 16 dignities or 16, you know, like virtues.
Okay? Interesting.
So again, it ain't the Enneagram, folks. You know, stop saying it. Okay, Homer didn't know the Enneagram. Okay, Dante didn't know the Enneagram. You know, just because there's nine of something in different places doesn't mean it had to do with the Enneagram, right? Abner Doubleday didn't know the Enneagram, even though there are nine baseball players on the field. All right, so.
Are you sure?
I am sure. I talk to him. Okay.
Is this falsifiable?
I follow him on Facebook. All right. So.
Clears it right up.
Yeah. Wow. Okay.
So we've made it to Aristotle and Achazo.
Yeah. Okay. So, but let's define. Okay. Yeah. Let's define what we're talking about. So it seems that everybody always wants to start with the vices. Okay. But again, if you go to Achazo, his view was the vices or the passions are an emotional reaction to the loss of the essential virtues. Okay. So if we look at point nine, the virtue is action. Okay, it's engagement with the world. It's acting upon the things that we need to act upon. But the opposite of doing that, or what we do instead of that, when we lose contact with it, there's a mental fixation that happens. And for the nine, that's indolence, right? It's kind of a resistance to change. Right. Acedia is another, another term used, by some. And so it's just this, I don't feel like it kind of approach, right? And then sloth is very similar, but sloth is this laziness. But again, that's, Achazo wasn't talking about physical laziness, right? He wasn't talking about, they just sit on the sofa and don't do any work. What he was saying is that they're lazy about understanding who they are. They're lazy about asserting who they are in the world. They're lazy about developing the capacity to love and be loved and to be benevolent and all these other sort of things, okay? So it's this desire to go to sleep to ourselves is the laziness he's talking about, right? It's not physical laziness. Okay? So the passion is an emotional reaction, whereas the fixation is the mental reaction to the loss of contact with something. The passion or the vice is the emotional reaction to it.
How does this fit into, like, with the core quality? There seems to be a few. I'm trying to just draw a mental map for the people out there.
Yeah. So it's for me. It's slightly different, right? I mean, it's, there are some common underpinnings and some similarities. Do you hear the rain coming here?
Okay. That's fine.
Yeah, I can't do anything about it. It's really, it's raining really, really hard.
Could you
get with
yourself?
The big guy? Yeah. Okay.
See, God's crying because we're talking about the vices, virtues.
And like, no. Not Neoplatonic essentialism again.
He didn't even define passion.
Okay. All right. Where were we?
Okay. Yeah. Core qualities. How does it all work? What's the map?
Yeah. I like to see them as different aspects, right? I mean, again, we're talking about a stew here, right? And so, it's hard to talk about any one of these things without seeing the other parts of it and seeing how they, they bleed into each other and how they affect each other, right? So if we were to look at the, the core quality of point nine we talked about last episode is about benevolence, right? It's this goodwill. Now, of course, when you're exercising goodwill, you are actually exercising it, right? It's doing something. It's not just, doesn't stop with the intention. So this, gets into this action piece that is the virtue of the nine. So they're kind of dependent upon each other, but they're slightly different elements of the whole, I think.
So this is the turnip of the stew.
I wasn't going to go there, but since you
You set it up. Yeah. Knocked it out of the park.
Teed up the turnip. Mario, am I hearing you say that there's a dynamic between it? It's like we lose touch with the virtue. That causes a mental experience. That causes an emotional experience. And the combination
of those things. So that's Achazo's perspective.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. That's Achazo's perspective. And I take a similar perspective with the core qualities and the strategies. Okay. Mm-hmm. Now, the thing I don't like to say which is what I hear Ichazo and others saying, is that there's a causal relationship here. Okay. Mm. This is the part that always gives me a little bit of trouble, that this, therefore, that. And I think that that's a little too prescriptive. It's a little too assumptive. You know, it's like saying, well, I became self-praised because I had this experience of lack in early life. Okay. Well, who knows? Okay. And so it's the same with the vices and virtues. Why does one have to cause the other, right? Why does the loss of one have to cause the other? Maybe they're just co-emergent properties of human nature. And I tend to take that view, that different characteristics that might seem contradictory are actually co-emergent, because humans, you know, humans have both the tendency, have the tendency to both compete and cooperate. Okay. That's just part of our evolutionary heritage. In order to survive in the world, we have to both compete with others and cooperate with others. Just like if you have multiple children, you know, sometimes they gang up on you, sometimes they fight each other. And so, you know, that's just nature. So I believe, and again, this is just my assumption, that it's more likely that they're just two things independent that exist because they're useful in some way, that, you know, then develop this sort of relationship over time, this sort of interact and interactive relationship. And I think it's important to say that these things are useful, right? Even though they're quote unquote sinful or negative, they're there for, because they serve a purpose in some way. The sloth of self-forgetting can be useful in certain examples. You know, the fixations can be useful in certain example, in certain situations, which is why they're there.
Mm-hmm. I have two questions there. Mm-hmm. One, what do you mean by that? All of that, everything previous? What?
Yeah.
But...
You mean second, for the past 29 minutes, Creek, or the, you know, yeah, is there a specific,
we start with
what
the
do you
Big
mean
Bang.
By?
Yeah, yeah.
So my intrepid co-host, yeah. Lee, look at you.
Hi.
I think you can answer both of these in the same sort of thing. So it's not, first of all, it's not unreasonable to think that these things, co-emergent doesn't mean they magically appeared or they were already implanted in us or anything. It, how we develop is through nature, nurture, the whole thing, and even nature and nurture's duality that I'm learning is not exactly accurate. But
it's not a duality; they're interwoven. Right. You know, you don't get one without the other.
Right. So I did not have. I mean, so as far as we know, I did not have a 4 DNA, and then it was just bound and determined to come up with these specific traits. It was through my own experience, my own maybe some level of wiring, but we can't know that for sure. So we just need to assume that, well, they're here. But that doesn't mean that it wasn't developed over time, correct?
Yes, and co-emergent doesn't mean innate necessarily.
Right.
Right. And they could be innate. Look, you might have, there might be a gene or a gene sequence that says 4, okay? Mm-hmm. Nobody's found it. Right. I hear people saying, you know, some people say, oh, the Enneagram is genetic. And I always say, well, what gene is it? Right. And, mm-hmm. you know, we don't know, but we don't know that it's not the case mm-hmm. either. The piece of it that I'm rejecting or that I'm uncomfortable with, I'll say, is the metaphysical assumption that these are certain qualities that are the good in the universe that we have lost contact with, and therefore this other thing, you know, is created, right? So we've lost contact with the virtue in a Platonic sense, and therefore, or we've lost contact with the essence of God, and therefore, you know, these vices fall into place, or these fixations fall into place to fill that hole. I think they'd be there even if we didn't lose contact. But then again, I don't think there's anything to lose contact with either, right? So
right.
these are all just aspects of human nature, and we don't need to mysticize them, in my view.
Yeah.
And I would add also not demonize them. I mean, this is a little bit of a rabbit hole, but there are sometimes, I think of the fixation at point one as anger. Yes. Sometimes you really need anger.
Absolutely. Right?
But over-identifying with it or using it maladaptively is where the struggle comes in. But sometimes that's what's really called for and around the circle for all of it. I think there's a negative connotation with vice.
Yes.
Right? But it's the overdoing of the thing that is the problem, not the thing.
That's exactly right. And that's what I meant by these things are useful sometimes, right? So, you know, if we take the fixation of vengeance, for example, right? You know, vengeance has its places, okay? Now, you know, depending on how we're applying it, you know, we don't want to do harm to others just because we feel there was some harm done to us. But, you know, sometimes it can get us out of bed in the morning when nothing else does. Okay. So, you know, all of these things have a place as long as they're not misused.
Before we move on to the next section, Mario, anything else you'd like to say just to kind of wrap up this history section of these ideas?
Not necessarily, just to reiterate that, you know, these things have not been an intact set of ideas throughout the, you know, the history of humanity. Okay. It starts with Achazo, right? Achazo was the first guy to say, you know what? Here are the nine passions. Here are the nine fixations. Here are the nine virtues. And we can't, you know, look, did he originate the ideas? Well, of course not, right? I mean, these are old ideas. But again, you know, if you go and look into the lists of virtues from different cultures and different societies and different traditions, they're all over the place, right? Some of them are really, really lengthy. Some of them are really short. So it starts with Achazo. Now, of course, it has been altered since then as well, right? You know, people will, you know, in my Substack article on myth-making and the Enneagram, which, you know, you can subscribe for free, marioscore.substack.com.
Like and subscribe.
Yeah, there you go. I forgot why I brought that up. Just to plug it, I guess. I don't know. Now, just, you know, was talking about how there's this tendency to think that it's all one thing, but all ideas evolve. And even these have evolved in different directions under different teachers who stop and say, yeah, you know what? Like there's this video I saw of Naranjo right before he passed away, where he was saying, you know, I've been thinking about eights lately, and I don't really think that vengeance is the fixation of the eight. And I, you know, and I'm thinking, well, dude, you got that one wrong, you know. So even Naranjo was, you know, changing them up until the last minute. So, which means we have to define our terms when we're talking about these things.
And you have not changed any of the language yet.
No, I don't, because it's not something I really focus on. So for me, whenever the idea comes up, I take, you know, I think of it the way that Achazo talked about it, right? You know, I think that's the most interesting, you know, list of these from the ones that I've seen vary from it. I still think his is better.
But I see you clarifying the definitions of vice and virtue and, you know, sort of digging into what those concepts are standing in for, right?
Yeah, but, you know, I mean, but I think that Achazo's work is pretty clear on what he means by those things. Now, again, I don't agree with his metaphysical assumptions, okay? Mm-hmm. But I think he was fairly rigorous at understanding the classical meaning of these terms. You know, what's interesting, too, about the Enneagram, because my initial religious spiritual background was from a Christian tradition. And then I became very enamored of the Eastern traditions. And then I was introduced to the Enneagram. And I was almost looking at it through the lens of the Eastern traditions more so than the Western traditions. But the Enneagram really is rooted in the Western Judeo-Christian traditions. I mean, it, you know, and when you read Achazo, you start to appreciate how much he leaned on the earlier Judeo-Christian tradition for this. So his definitions are pretty good, really, is what it comes down to, because they're consistent with the historical definitions of each of these issues.
Well, if we could bring it from whenever a Chazo time is, the what, late 1950s?
The age of Aquarius, yeah.
Okay, yeah. That'll clear it right up.
By the way, I gotta share a story here about the Chazo. I'm not a big fan of the Eureka school, you know, some great ideas and whatnot, but a whole lot of crazy too. And I remember being in, I think it was Buenos Aires, and talking to a couple of the Eureka people in 2011. And they were telling me how the world was not coming to an end in 2012, but there was going to be a solar event that caused half the population to become enlightened and the other half to go crazy. And it was, you know, and that's why the Mayan calendar ended at that point. So,
Wow.
So, you know, maybe that happened and I, you know, I didn't get the memo, but.
So yeah. I actually went to the Mayan temple.
Oh, did you?
Yeah. I did.
Uh-huh. Did you add a few pages to the calendar by any chance?
Well, so on the bus ride there, this like Mayan expert just is like, everyone said that the Mayan calendar ended, but that's not how they saw time. It was more like we're transitioning into a new set of I forget the exact terminology. It's like the equivalent of moving into a new year, basically.
Yeah. Yeah.
It wasn't an end. It was just like, oh, we're going to transition into another cycle.
Right.
And so we all catastrophized, surprisingly.
Yeah. About things that we didn't actually have a clue about what they actually meant.
And she also said something like, because their calendar was so accurate that, you know why we have like leap year?
Yeah.
In the Mayan calendar, it wouldn't be necessary to have...
Wow.
Because it was so accurate.
Wow.
But then the white guy came and misinterpreted the Mayan calendar, and now we have leap year.
So, and
summary
doomsday.
Of history.
And doomsday.
And doomsday, yeah.
I heard the other day, and I don't know whether it's true. It's falsifiable, I imagine. But that because the rotation of the Earth is speeding up, they're thinking that they might have to add a second.
Oh, really?
Like a literal second to time. To make the calendar heavy close quotes work.
Right.
Yeah.
Know? So it's a construct time.
Boy.
Much like the Enneagram. So we're back to that.
Yeah. That's a second I'll never get back. Yeah.
That's right. You're welcome.
The moon is also moving away from us. Did you know that?
The universe is expanding, Creek.
Well,
well, that's interesting. So I did not know that. And it's actually kind of surprising because usually mass and gravity attract items. So I would have thought it's getting closer to us, but
So like the solar eclipse in, I don't know how long, but will not be a thing in the future.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
Did you check the Mayan calendar?
Because it'll be behind the sun, or it'll be so far away that
I'm not sure we need to concern ourselves with it immediately.
No, I think we got some time.
We've got that time.
It's like Alvy Singer catastrophizing, a young Alvy Singer catastrophizing over, you know, that the universe is going to collapse in a billion years, right? So.
All right.
That's a Woody Allen throwback for the kids. All right.
For the kids?
Yeah.
That's like,
I think they're a little older.
It's AARP now.
Yeah.
I mean, I was clarifying who Alvy Singer was for the kids. Yes.
All right. Got it. Okay. All right.
Let's clarify the uses of the virtues of the gods.
You're so good at transitions, man.
Let's get back on track here, right? All right. Okay. So, what was your transition, Lee?
After Alvy Singer,
We
clarify the uses of the vices and the virtues.
Yeah. So, what are they good for, right?
What are they good
for? Is the question. Yeah.
What have they done for us lately?
What have they done? So, look, I think these are useful ideas. And even though it's not something I traditionally teach in our certification program, next one of which begins May 6th, by the way. So, enneagramondemand.com. And I generally don't use them in my work in organizations because, again, it's kind of a theological concept that has to do with sin and virtue and all this. And again, I remember hearing one Enneagram teacher who did one of her first corporate gigs and told a guy that, well, you know, the problem is you're the lust type. And, you know, and it's like, you know, yeah, you don't do that.
HR is on the way.
But it's a useful idea. For example, if we stick with the lust type, so I'm an Enneagram type 8, and the vice, you know, or the passion associated with my type is lust. And what lust refers to here is an inability to let go of something, right? It's just this, I've got this thing in my head, I can't think about anything else, right? I just, you know, and, you know, people who know me and work with me will say, yeah, man, you know, once he's got it in his head, he's, you know, it's the dog with a bone and it's not going anywhere, right? So you got to let him get it out of its system and, you know, all these sort of things. And that's my emotional, you know, challenge of, I just can't let it go. Right? Whether it's something positive or something negative. Okay. So it's not necessarily a sexual lust, although, you know, that's there too. But it's just this need to be unable to see anything else once I have something on my mind. Okay. And recognizing that in myself is important because sometimes it helps me get out of it faster. And for the people around me to understand that, well, yeah, that's, you know, that's his thing, right? And it makes me a little bit easier to cope with at times. Now, the mental version of this is what's called a fixation, right? It's this thing that I think about all the time, right? The lust is an emotional characteristics, right? I just feel this thing, whereas the vengeance is the thing I think about. And vengeance, you know, it sounds like a harsh word, but it's really just for the eight, this need to get back on top. Okay. It's that, you bested me, I've got to best you, right? You've insulted me, I've got to insult you, but better. You hit me once, I got to hit you twice, you know, sort of thing. So it's always about this getting back on top piece, which is what vengeance is about. And, you know, the Godfather is such a great example of eightness and vengeance, right? I mean, it's all about vengeance. And of course, at the end of the third one, it's about the ramifications of this, you know, fixation of vengeance, that he loses everything that means anything to him because he was so focused on vengeance his whole life. So, you know, so the fixation is this sort of mental thing. Now, again, that's something important or helpful to understand, right? If you deal with me or if I think about myself, it's like, okay, you're falling into this pattern again, right? Maybe you need to step back and take a deep breath and ask, is this really worth it? And you know, again, the same thing, if you're working with an eight, say, yeah, well, you know, they've got to let this run its course. So let me just kind of, you know, stay out of the way for a while or, you know, however we deal with it. Now, when it comes to the, you know, the virtue, there's a couple of ways to think about it, right? So some might say, well, the virtue is what emerges naturally. I don't like to think that anything emerges fully formed. I think everything needs to be developed. The way Achazo talked about the virtue at point eight, which is innocence, it's this ability to kind of see the world as it is and be okay with it, right? Of, you know, just not feeling the need to fix things and avenge things and control things or dominate things, but just, you know, step back and just be okay with things as they are. And he, again, takes this sort of metaphysical perspective of accepting that the universe is good as it is and so forth. Not something I really, you know, feel that comfortable with assuming, but again, it's this idea of just sort of letting go of things that matters. That's good stuff for an eight to understand, right? I mean, you know, that's really useful stuff. It's just language that is hard to, I was going to say hard to sell, but that sounds too mercenary, right? It's just, it's not language that everybody's comfortable with.
But I think the dynamics and the concepts are important to be able to navigate, right?
Absolutely.
And so understanding or updating or de-religiosifying, I can't even make that word, depathologizing the language, right? How do we update it to a way that is relatable practically in life to see these things? Because I'm anticipating that as you dive into going around the Enneagram with the types, we're going to see a similar dynamic of this fuel is emerging and how it is spent is either working well or over or underdoing something and creating a less adaptive version of seeing reality and relating to it.
Yeah. 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 When I'm working with a client and one of these issues is coming up, then I'll talk about these ideas, right? It's not like I'm going to see an eight wrestling with vengeance and say, well, I'm not going to talk about that because, it's not something I teach,
right?
Well, of course, right? if it's useful, I'm going to use it.
Yeah.
But I prefer to look for other means, if possible, to explain the same idea.
So you'll talk about it without necessarily talking about it.
Sometimes. Okay. But look, when you're coaching somebody, you get to know them. You get to know what mm-hmm. their tolerance for different things is. And sure. some people, some of the people that I work with are very religious and very open to these ideas. And in those situations, I'll use it, right? Because mm-hmm. my job is to use whatever it takes to help the client grow.
Mm-hmm. So real quick, how do we make these things practical? It's good to notice those things. And then what's the action step after that?
Yeah, well, so the action step is, going to depend on what the issue is, right? So I think a good step is to, my approach is to take the Aristotelian approach, right? When I see that I'm out of balance on a thing, say it's vengeance, right? It's like, okay, well, what's the golden mean here between overdoing the vengeance thing, but underdoing, standing up for myself? Okay, so what's the appropriate response in this situation? Okay, am I using a sledgehammer to kill a fly, or am I letting the fly drive me crazy all night, right? So there's something in between that we can do. So that's kind of my approach to things. What is the proportional response to this, rather than falling into either extreme or too far along the continuum?
Awesome. Yeah, I just wanted to give people a little bit of something to grab onto, but we'll definitely be hopping into more specifics as we get to the nine different types. So thanks everyone for checking in, listening. Yeah.
And thanks, Lee, for being here.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you, Lee.
Thanks for having me. Miss you, MJ.
All right. Bye, everyone.
So long.
Thanks for listening to the Awareness to Action Enneagram podcast. If you're interested in more information or talking to Mario, MJ, or myself, feel free to reach out to us through the links in the show notes or by emailing info@awarenesstoaction.com. All episode transcriptions and further information can be found at awarenesstoaction.com/podcast.